So I would like to go right into our call right now and introduce Dr. Nawang Phuntsok. Our theme today is on that of compassion. I would like to tell you a little bit about our guest. We're very grateful that he's here. He's got quite an interesting background. He's an associate professor of education in the Department of Education at California State University, Fullerton. His areas of specialization include multicultural education and school curriculum development. He integrates postmodern educational perspectives and practices into the process of curriculum delineation. He's got a high level of proficiency in Tibetan, English, and Hindi. His current research focuses on culturally responsive teaching practices in schools populated by students of diverse ethnic, cultural, and linguistic backgrounds. Nawang was exiled with his family from Tibet at an early age, and he now studies the challenges of educating children in the diaspora. He is the first Tibetan educator teaching at a major teacher education university in the United States. He has helped to organize two major events in Orange County, California, with the gracious presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the helm. And Nawang is a practicing Buddhist. So welcome today, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for your wonderful introduction. I'm a little bit so embarrassed, actually.
Well, everyone should know that much about you as we begin. So, Jim.
Okay.
Do you want to begin?
I'd love to begin, and I'm intrigued by Nawang's work, and I'd like him to say a word or two about the whole idea of diversity. You teach in schools with students of diverse ethnic and cultural and linguistic backgrounds. I've been talking at all of these, through all of these presentations, about the idea that we're living in an age of dramatic cultural evolutionary progress. And it seems to me that the fact that in our communities we're taking more account of the diversity that makes up our communities is critical. Now, tell us more about your work, because I think it's really fascinating. I think it's extremely important.
Well, I primarily work with elementary school teachers because teachers play such a crucial role in the classrooms, particularly working with children from different ethnic, racial, religious backgrounds. And if a teacher is coming from a place of understanding and appreciation, validation for different cultural backgrounds, and then they are more likely to interact positively with those students, who will then feel welcomed, and you know their experiences will be validated in the schooling process. And through this kind of a process, I think they are likely to feel more empowered. And then they're likely to engage in academic learning in the schools. Otherwise, learning becomes kind of a secondary issue for them because they're kind of struggling with their own emotional issues, psychological issues, and, you know, some of these issues are embedded in the cultural misunderstandings that seem to emerge quite often in the classroom settings.
Well, you must deal with the whole idea of the opposition to cultural diversity. People who don't like multilingualism and that sort of thing?
Yes, but at the same time, I tell teachers that, you know, if you work from a place of understanding, actually you're really promoting, academic learning for the students. And also, if you, let's say, validate different languages in the classroom, really the interesting outcome of this language validation is that students are more likely to learn English language in the process. But if you deny the native language, they're likely to be turned off. And so then English language learning is compromised very seriously in the learning process. So really there's a lot of benefit, you know, that can come about when a teacher comes from a place of understanding, appreciation, validation for, you know, different cultures, languages, religions, and whatnot. So I think at the end, you know, this country as a whole is going to benefit. It's going to really, you know, have very productive citizens at the end.
And so I think most of us who are listening couldn't agree more. And one of the things that I always emphasize when I talk about what I call sea change, or the whole process of dramatic cultural evolution that we're going through, is a growing appreciation of interdependence.
Right.
That one thing depends on another, and whether we're talking about healthcare or mental health or cultural diversity, the idea that one reads on the other and feeds into the other seems
right.
critical.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, if the classroom teacher provides some experiences that would validate children's cultural background, and then these children are more likely to actually learn American culture in the process, because they say to themselves, well, this culture is really wonderful. It really allows me this space to, in fact, appreciate my own, you know, ethnic cultural heritage. If that aspect is denied, you know, they'll feel very dehumanized, and then, you know, very often, you know, their academic interest is really turned off in the process. So I really try to, you know, encourage my teachers to think from a very, you know, broad perspective, that these children, although they may be displaced in terms of a land or a place, but there's no need for the teachers to displace their culture, because this culture is so crucial for the students. If this is the only link they have with their country of origin or with their parents, and also this is the only link that will link them to the future and also to the present. So, you know, this culture is not to be taken very lightly, particularly for those students who come from a culture that is so very different from the culture that is to be found in the United States.
And well, at this point, I would. I'm sorry. At this point, I would always be asking you, if you were sitting down for
mm-hmm.
the first time with persons, and in many cases, perhaps today you are, who don't know anything about Buddhism, what would you want to tell them? And I think I want to interject the idea, because the study of Buddhism was. Also the topic of my doctoral dissertation, and in that I emphasized what we've been talking about, the idea
mm-hmm.
of interdependence.
Right,
but
right.
what would you tell us, let's assume we all know nothing about Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
what might you tell us about Buddhism that would help us to understand what you've already told us about your work?
Really, Buddhism respects and affirms all forms of life. I think that's a very important principle in Buddhism. And hence, Buddhism encourages us to adopt a non-harming attitude in terms of...
Non-harming.
Non-harming, yes. Attitude towards all sentient beings in terms of our thinking and also in terms of our action, because they must go together. And then I think at its core, it is sort of like compassion and kindness-centered religion. And I'm always saying to myself, you know, if we could imagine a world where kindness really pervades everywhere, I think this would be truly a beautiful heaven on earth. And this kind of a, you know, heaven on earth is possible when we all practice kindness and compassion to all forms of life, really. And so that is, I think, a very beautiful aspect of Buddhism that Buddhism emphasizes.
We were going to ask you about compassion in any case. Now
mm-hmm.
let's circle around and say,
mm-hmm.
doesn't compassion make particular sense if we live in a universe in which we are all interdependent?
Right. Definitely, compassion... transcends all forms of barriers, I think, in my mind, you know, in terms of race, you know, gender, ethnicity, religion, in fact. I think compassion is to be found in all of us, you know, and it's really the kind of like a driving force in all of us as we all belong to this one huge humanity. And actually, I'm very often reminded of what His Holiness said many, many times. I think that really, the more I think on his statement, the more, you know, it makes not only sense, but it's really a very powerful kind of a statement. His Holiness said, kindness is my religion. And if you all
kindness
is my religion. And if you all come to that kind of understanding, that if you all accept that premise, that kindness is whatever religion that you and I might belong to, I think that will really unite us all in a very powerful way. So I hope we will pay more attention to what His Holiness has said in terms of kindness as His religion. I thought that was really very beautiful statement that he made, actually, with regard to compassion in Buddhism.
Well, it fits so nicely with something that we have all talked about in all of these conversations, which is the role of interfaith and interreligious dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something His Holiness has been engaged in for a long time. And why is that so important? Why is it not enough for me simply to sit in the context of my own religion? What do I need to know about yours?
Well, you know, actually, first of all, I would say interfaith encounter is really very important, particularly in this, age where there's a lot of misunderstandings about different religions, particularly, you know, in this very difficult age. And I think, you know, when we are engaged in interfaith kind of discussion and encounter, we are likely to learn more about other religions. And what will happen is the more one learns about other religions, the more one learns about one's own religion as well. So there's a benefit that can really come from, you know, this having this interest to learn about other religions. You know, because that other religion provides the template or the mirror for yourself. Otherwise, there's no way you can tell, oh, my religion is wonderful, beautiful. We need this mirror, you know, in order for us to really see if there are some blemishes on my face or on my lips or my eyes, or do I need to put some different hair color, whatever it is. You know, the mirror will have to let us know. So in the same way, this other religion kind of like provides that template, that beautiful mirror that is so crucial for all of us, you know, to help us move beyond this, you know, our own kind of, you know.
I think everyone who is involved in this conversation today is going to take away this idea of the mirror.
We might
provided
end up
by the other tradition. I think we're all going to go out and buy an interreligious mirror, and the first person that markets it is going to make a killing.
Jim, you and I should market that now.
Really? I think
and
we
then,
should.
And then donate.
And we'll talk after the conversation.
Interfaith, you know, conference.
An interfaith mirror. I would like to ask Nuang a question, backing up a little bit about the theme of compassion, because when I heard him talking about his own work, it struck me very deeply, and I value this very much, that it's a place where, even though we consider there to be a separation between so-called church and state, it's important that our spiritual principles be brought into our professional life, and a lot of us can't find a way of doing that, but as Nuang was expressing the way that he interacted with his teachers and basically his philosophy of education, it sounded as if there was so much focus on compassion for students coming from diverse cultural paths in order for them to be comfortable and safe, rather than to force them into a style of learning that doesn't feel comfortable and safe for them. So I think my question for Nuang has something to do with what are some of your feelings about how your own spiritual principles become active in your professional life?
Actually, you know, although I don't really make them kind of like conspicuous part of my description, but they do play a very important underlying sort of like force in my teaching, and not only teaching, but in my interactions with my students. You know, I come across as someone who is truly loving and caring for my students, and I think that's a very, you know, positive role model for them. So hopefully these teachers will then be very loving and caring for their students in their own classrooms. And that has been a very consistent sort of finding in terms of my interactions with my students. And of course, you can't fake this, you know, this authentic reaction. It has to come from a very genuine place. And so, but actually, as you said it, you know, spiritual, you know, as you know, spirituality has a definitely a very important place in our professional socialization. Without that, really, you know, even your profession seems meaningless. And so this, when your profession is embedded in a spiritual sort of like grounding, really it provides that meaning, purpose, direction, at least in my case. So, you know, I don't see myself as, you know, separate from my spiritual background. It is very much part of the way I teach, very much part of the way I interact, without, in fact, making it a very big sort of like a deal in the process. But it does play a very important role in terms of my thinking, in terms of my, you know, interactions. And so, you know, it has definitely a very important place in my, at least, professional, you know, growth, as well as my, you know, relationships with my students
absolutely.
And colleagues.
I wish we had more. Go ahead, Jim.
This is to Barbara and Nawang, and I'm saying that here's a question I wish we had been asking every time, and let's do. Nawang, you've spoken a lot about spirituality, and one of the most common questions I get is, what's the difference between religion and spirituality? I think we're all fairly clear on what we mean by religion, but what do you mean when you talk about spirituality?
Well, spirituality really is some of those fundamental principles, you know, that really unite all of us without the trappings of this, you know, sort of like religious label. And, you know, for example, like compassion is really a spiritual dimension in my thinking, love and kindness, respect for the earth. So these are really some, you know, basis of spirituality. They are not necessarily associated with a particular religion. In fact, they transcend all the religions in the world, at least in my thinking. So something that really brings our spirits together. I give you one good example, really. I think that might help us understand. Let's say, for example, there was an accident on the freeway and someone has been really hurt very badly. And anyone who is driving by, he is going to stop by that individual. And we are not at all interested what might be his or her religious background. We are going to show compassion, loving kindness to that individual right away. So, you know, that is an example of where really, compassion has transcended, you know, this trappings of a, you know, religious label. So I think that's. I hope I'm making it clear. So
yeah,
that's
you're,
where
spirituality.
You've settled on loving kindness, which I think is a wonderful place.
So when having said that, it sounds as if we almost can define what makes us. What we share in common might be defined by these kind of universal principles that
right.
that all human beings can support and wish to demonstrate more of. And while we have such great, seemingly great religious differences among us, it seems as if you're actually suggesting it's a good idea to concentrate on those principles that we
right.
share in common, because they would be embraced by all of our religions, right?
Right. I think, you know, if you take away the labels and look into each religion, I'm sure you're likely to find those, you know, universal principles. And, you know, the more we are focused on the boxes, the less we are likely to find what is inside the box. So I think spirituality really brings out the best in all the humanity. And actually, I agree with you, Barbara, really, you know, if we can all look into those universal principles, you know, we're likely to have more peace and harmony in the world. and, you know, less sort of like, you know, problems that seem to emanate from religious differences.
And His Holiness is a big proponent of that discussion. He's always reminding us that of the importance to understand our own tradition and be tolerant and understanding of other people's religions, but he's always stressing those common principles and how we would have a more peaceful world if we behaved more like Buddhists.
But I really can't resist saying, especially when we're talking to Nawang, that each of the traditions that we've spoken about and each of those that we'll be speaking about as we proceed in this series also insists that there's a way to delve deeper and to find that spirituality involves a deeper search for the hidden capacities, let's say, of humanness.
Right.
We could actually ask a little bit. I mean, since what you're saying, both of you,
I'm trying to.
And Nawang, it seems to me that all of us here are very familiar with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and that we might want to talk a little bit about him since he's been such a great teacher for all of us. We've worked with him several times in the Association for Global New Thought, and Jim's worked with him. So I think Jim had some questions for you about that.
Well, I think I've just expressed it. The idea that spirituality means it certainly begins in compassion, but it then expands into a deepening of what it means to be human and who I am in relationship to you and to the universe and so on. And whenever His Holiness speaks, there's always this sense that the capacity of the spiritual search, or the range of the spiritual search, is endless. Well, let me put it this way and say there is such a thing as the spiritual search.
Well, one of the things that I know His Holiness has been interested in is that he's a very interdisciplinary thinker as well. And while he's been concentrating on spiritual searching, he's gotten into many other disciplines, one of them being science. He's very fascinated with physics and with neuroscience, and I think that maybe it would be kind of interesting to talk a little bit about that.
Well, another thing I was just thinking is, you know, like, the more you and I, for example, study our own religions, I think eventually it should lead us to really this very deep search into our own spiritual, you know, spirituality. I see religions helping us, in fact, you know, really, you know, to engage in this very deep sort of like study, so that you and I can really find our own spirituality. I think that, and then of course His Holiness does the same thing. He looks into science, for example, as a source of finding his spirituality. And so, I mean, His Holiness is really a marvelous example for all of us to follow. He does not really promote Buddhism to the neglect of other religions, but he sees all religions as having the potential to help us all to improve our, you know, living conditions and spiritual conditions. And and so he's even willing to learn from the science so that some of the, you know, if there is some misconception in Buddhism, that would be taken care of through a scientific inquiry. So, you know, he's really kind of marvelous teacher for all of us to follow. I know it's going to be very difficult, but nevertheless, someone to emulate in terms of our own, you know, practices.
Absolutely. I remember once when we were all in Dharamsala and we were sitting someplace with Tenzin Gyatso La, and he was sort of you know, sort of happily complaining that he said, His Holiness teaches us all about Tibetan Buddhism and all of the details and nuances. And then as soon as we've learned how to be good Buddhists, then he goes on to something beyond that, and he expects us to learn, throw that all away and go beyond into some other territory. So he's very hard to keep up with because intellectually he's so adept. And I think that he was complaining in a kind of a happy way that it always kept things interesting.
I think, you know, his scholarship and interest in other disciplines, like, for example, science, it's really, you know, and again, he, of course, shares those, aspects of spirituality in his writings and in his teachings. And so, in fact, science is helping us really to affirm some of the basic principles that we find in Buddhism. So, Buddhism does not contradict scientific, findings. Rather, there's a lot of complementariness, I would say. Of course, I'm not really an expert in neither of them, but based on my sort of readings in the past, there's really a lot of things that can be learned from the science, as well as science can learn something from Buddhism. So that is a very beautiful, synergy that is taking place.
I was really struck by something Nawang said. I'm sorry if I'm interrupting, but something you said earlier about His Holiness suggesting that if something new comes up in science and Buddhism has not yet considered this, then Buddhism has to rethink. Now, how different that is from some of the presentations that we get from some of the world's major religions. I think all the world's great religious traditions at their deepest level of reflection and thought would echo what His Holiness has to say, but that's not always what we hear from the spokespersons of those religions. The idea that the insight of religion contradicts science, and here's His Holiness saying, well, if science comes up with a new point of view and we haven't thought about it, we need to rethink. I love that.
I think that's really a very progressive, thinking of His Holiness. And I think Buddhism sort of really emphasizes that kind of interdependence, that you can learn something from.
And I think that's true across the Buddhist perspective.
What do we think are some of the things that make that sort of make Tibetan Buddhism distinct from the other paths of Buddhism? I'm thinking now about some of our callers who are not necessarily well versed in the definitions, the basic definitions of Buddhism, and I was wondering if before we go into our breakout groups, if we could just take a minute and talk about what Tibetan Buddhism has to offer that's very unique and outstanding among the different traditions.
Did I say, or Jim, I think?
I would like to ask both of you.
Jim, you want to say first, or?
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead. I'll simply say that, from the point of view of the student of religions, you have the Theravada Buddhist tradition in Southeast Asia and the Mahayana Buddhist tradition in the Far East, which includes, in a way, Tibetan Buddhism. And Theravada tends to be more monastic, tends to be a bit more on the traditional side or conservative side, and Mahayana Buddhism tends to be much more expansive in the sense that there are lots of different ways to practice it. But I think one of the most amazing things about Buddhism, I'll simply say that sometimes scholars have said, the one is Protestant, the other is Catholic, and I'm not going to even say which is which. But one of the most amazing things about Buddhism is that the core teaching seems to be pretty consistent across the range of traditions, across the Theravada, which means the way of the elders, and the Mahayana, which means the big raft or the big vehicle teaching. Mahayana, the tradition of the Far East, and that embraces, in a way, Tibetan Buddhism, includes many more than does the teaching of Southeast Asia. But what strikes me is that both agree that the human being is a work in progress. And that's what I always love about Buddhism, the idea that we are, and I'm going to borrow a phrase that comes actually from Hinduism that I think finds its really full expression in Buddhism, that every sinner has a future and every saint has a past.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
So that's my 10-cent version.
Mm-hmm. Nuang, did you have some thoughts about that?
Whenever I actually go and attend some Buddhist teachings, one thing that really amazed me is this uninterrupted oral transmission that dates back to Buddha himself. So when I listen to a Tibetan teacher, for example, a Buddhist teacher, scholar, they will recite, the lineage orally. I'm like, so you might actually end up just listening to the names of the preceding, teachers almost 10 minutes or maybe longer than that.
Wow.
And so that's really a very beautiful, aspect of Tibetan Buddhism. I think Tibetan Buddhism is the only one that has maintained that authenticity, sanctity, and the originality to some extent, really. I mean, that's something very beautiful. And then, another thing I want to say is Tibetan Buddhism is very much part of Tibetan individual's lifestyle. There's not any, separation between, today I'm going to be Buddhist and tomorrow I'm going to be not doing Buddhism, something. Our own living, the living process itself is very much embedded in Buddhist principles and practices. So I think that sort of like non-separation between our daily life, living practices from Buddhism, I think it's very wonderful because then an individual is likely to be really spiritually, embedded in whatever he or she does. And hence, in Tibetan Buddhism, you don't have to really have a very specific day of the week to go to the temple, for example. Temple can be with you all the time. In fact, your body itself is the temple. And hence, I find that as really, very helpful in my own, daily practice to be a good Buddhist, which is sometimes a challenge, but I try my best. And so this is where this helpfulness of Tibetan Buddhism comes into play in my life.
If you had to say to our group just very quickly the essence of your practice as a Buddhist, not Tibetan Buddhist, but the essence of your practice as a Buddhist would be what?
Well, as soon as I wake up, I'm always thinking of my day with some very positive thoughts. And the way I do that is, see a Buddha's image or do some offering, and I do a little bit of meditation, and I recite prayers, actually, sometimes mindlessly. But it's a very good practice. The more you recite prayers, the more your thinking is reinforced with some of those positive energies and positive thoughts. So I kind of do that. That's the first thing I do. Before I begin to worry about my Starbucks or something like that, I always begin my practice with some positive energy, and even before I take my shower and stuff like that. So I think that sort of like sets the tone for me, at least for the whole day. My day tends to go very, positively, and I'm less sort of like angry with myself and with other individuals I come in touch with. And so, and then again, as I had said, I really, Buddhism is very much part of my own life. There's no separation at all. Whatever I do while eating, whatever it is, talking, there is that overwhelming presence of Buddhist thoughts in my mind, sometimes unconsciously. But sometimes, of course, things can be very conscious. But otherwise, it's sort of like so strongly embedded, I think that's the right word I would like to use, in my own life. I don't have to make this extra attempt to be a nice Buddhist for a while or something of that kind. But I'm consistently, being a good Buddhist. I think that's what I want to say. I hope I made sense.
Really. Well, that makes wonderful sense. And many, if not most of the callers on this series are coming from the spiritual tradition of New Thought from Unity and Religious Science churches. And one of our main, I would say, practices is what you have described very beautifully, really, how to not separately practice a religion or a spiritual path, but how
right.
to weave that spirituality into our everyday life and not separate it. And so let's just take about 5 minutes or so to conclude the conversation. There are a few things that we'd like to cover. So, Jim, do you want to take the lead on that?
Noong, when we were chatting during our little break, you spoke about your own experience of true happiness and the nature of it and so on. Can you share that with the rest of us?
I was just sharing my experiences with my parents when they were alive in India, after they were exiled into India from Tibet. And they lived with really minimum. There was just a very simple shelter and just enough kind of basic food to eat. Yet, whenever I would visit them, they seemed so happy. They seemed so contented. They were so happy. There was a smile on their face all the time. I never saw them to be unhappy and sort of irritated. And I might have spent at least month long with my parents in their, in their site in southern India, where they lived with minimum, actually. Really, there wasn't even proper sanitation for them. Their living conditions, as compared to other countries like the West, were just really, very, very, really bad, I would say, for sure. But yet, they were so happy. And so I always wondered as to why they seemed so happy when, I, who has lived in the United States for the last about 25 years, I do sometimes, experience unhappiness, some agitation, whereas, I should be perfectly happy because I live in a country where there is everything plenty. And so this has really forced me to think a little bit. And what I realize is the less possession you have, the more happy you are. And the more possessions you have, the less happy you are. So that is kind of like, interesting paradoxical nature of my life I realized recently. And so I thought I'd just kind of share this with our, group, just to really, this is my own experiential kind of realization with regard to happiness, contentment. And so
I was going to ask you about the future of Buddhism in East and West, but I think instead, as we wind up, I'm going to ask you about your whole idea of meditation. It seems to me that that your parents and that what you're pointing at is not a special practice that you set aside every day.
Right, you're right.
But an attitude that you bring to your whole life, an attitude of mindfulness. Can you just take us out on that notion?
Well, definitely, if you engage in meditation, that will help you to develop this mindfulness. There is no doubt about that. But at the same time, your mindfulness has to be a living practice. It can't be like something that one would do on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or on a Sunday, for example. But it has to become part of your own, you know, lifestyle. And I think that's what my parents have really practiced, and they try to show to me. And I try to emulate their practices as well. And so mindful has to be a part of your internal thinking and external action at the same time. I think that's what makes us to be happy individuals. And then I would like to say that even if, Jim, you didn't want to ask me this question about the future of Buddhism, and really my hunch is there is growing interest, you know, in Buddhism all over the world, and which is wonderful. And so long as, in my mind, Buddhist principles and practices are integrated into different religions, really, I think that is really the purpose of Buddhism. It doesn't have any other purpose other than helping sentient beings and helping humanity to, you know, improve our living conditions, our lifestyle, and our thinking and habits and attitudes. And so long as Buddhism is able to do that, even if it does not exist as a Buddhist practice, it has served its purpose. You know, because, you know, Buddhism is not really a proselytizing religion at all. So I think that's where the beauty of Buddhism lies, really. If people are able to embrace Buddhist practices and principles, it really doesn't matter whether one calls himself or herself a Buddhist practitioner or not, because the label is not that essential. It is, in fact, kind of impermanent. But those practices and principles will be, you know, very important, and, you know, will have enduring impact in the lives of individuals as well as the humanity as a whole. So I
can't think of a better way to end our conversation. That's terrific, Noang. Thank you so much.